I wonder if there's anyone here today who's actually 30 today, 30th birthday today. Anybody? No? Anybody with a 30th birthday this week? No? Anybody becoming 30 this year? Ah, right. Well, good. I heard the other day that 30th birthdays are filled with angst and beginnings of midlife crises and so on. Don't quite remember that happening to me. But here we have in this passage of Ezekiel, if not a 30th birthday, certainly his 30th year. I'm fairly certain that that's what verse 1 means, that the 30th year Ezekiel is telling us how old he was. And in Old Testament Israel, the 30th year was quite important if you were trained to be a priest, because that was the year in which you could actually start work in the temple as a priest. We know that from the book of Leviticus and Numbers. Actually, as it happens, I was ordained in the Church of England just a few days before my own 30th birthday a few years ago. And Ezekiel was training to be a priest. He tells us that he was the son of a man called Buzi, of a priest's family. He had been brought up in Jerusalem, and here he was on his 30th birthday, but instead of being ordained to the priesthood in the temple in Jerusalem, where he should have been, he tells us in this opening verse, I was among the exiles at the Kibar River in Babylon, which was about 1,000 miles away by foot from Jerusalem. What on earth was he doing there? How did that happen, that he was in that situation? So we need to step back a little bit and just to spend a few minutes filling in something of the background of what was going on at this particular point in biblical history. I want us to see something of the state of the world at that time, the state of the people of Israel at that time, and then the state of the question that they were facing because of what had happened to them. And then we'll turn to the text itself. It was about 600 years before Christ. That's the date, about 597 BC. The Middle East was in turmoil, as it seems perennially to be. There was a superpower in the region. It was called Assyria, and it was collapsing. In fact, it pretty well had collapsed because a younger kingdom of Babylon was overtaking it. And all the smaller states off to the west, that is the west of what we call the Middle East, in other words, now in Palestine, small states like Judah and others were spoiling for a fight. They wanted their freedom. They'd been oppressed for a century and a half by Assyria, and they weren't going to be ruled over by this new upstart king, Nebuchadnezzar. And so in 597, the then king of Judah, called Jehoiakim, rebelled against Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar was having nothing of that. He attacked Jerusalem. Jehoiakim got fright, surrendered the city, and conveniently died, or possibly was murdered. He was replaced by the king who's mentioned here, Jehoiakim. It's a problem. Just the M comes before the N. That's why I always remember which comes first. Jehoiakim, and then Jehoiakim. Well, Nebuchadnezzar, just to make sure the city didn't do it again, took hostages. In fact, he took a large number of people from Jerusalem off into captivity, including the king, the new king Jehoiakim, and Ezekiel, and many others of the priestly families and the leading families in Jerusalem. This is sometimes called the first deportation. He didn't yet destroy the city. He left Zedekiah on the throne in Jerusalem, and Jeremiah was still the prophet back in Jerusalem at this time. But now Ezekiel was among that first bunch of hostages, prisoners of war, who had been dragged away from their homeland in Jerusalem, 1,000 miles across the desert to the land of Babylon. That's how it is that Ezekiel ended up where he is in chapter 1, verse 1 to 3. That was the state of the world. What was the state of the people? How did it feel like to be among these exiles at that time? Well, we don't really need to use a lot of imagination because we know from the world we live in and the kind of things we see on our television, even if we haven't experienced them personally, and it's possible, of course, that some of you tonight here from other countries may well have done, it must have been a huge shock to these people. It must have seemed almost unthinkable that such a thing could have happened to their city and to their country. And when, 10 years later, the city was finally destroyed and the temple burned down and most of the rest of the population was carried off into exile, it was even worse. And we read about that later in the book of Ezekiel. Just try to imagine the state of mind that these people would have been in. They were physically dislocated from their own homeland. And we've seen TV pictures of what that means to people. You just look at something like Sudan and other parts of the world, people who are driven out of their homes in fear and trembling and taken off to live somewhere else in a refugee camp or a prisoner camp. They were psychologically traumatized by this, the horror, the shock, the disbelief of what was happening to them. Just this week, aren't we? We're celebrating the 60th anniversary of VE Day here in Britain, and we are being told by those who remember that, something of the shock and horror that it was when they were children to be taken off, to be evacuated out of London, sometimes to see their families only every month or hardly ever at all, to lose loved ones. And some of them say that that psychological trauma of those years has stayed with them all through their lives. They were physically dislocated, psychologically traumatized. They were spiritually hardened. Because what we know about these people is that for many years they refused to understand what the prophets had been telling them, that it was their own wickedness and sin and rebellion against God which led to this situation. They went on and on making excuses and denials for what had happened to them. And they were also, fourthly, theologically baffled. They just wondered, where is God? Why has he allowed this to happen? What is he trying to say to us? How could they interpret such events in the light of their history and what their prophets had been saying about them? So that was something of the confused state of these people at this time as a background to the book. What then was their reaction? How did they respond to what had happened to them? Now you're going to have to take my word for it because I don't have time to look at all the passages in the Old Testament around this time which tell us exactly how these people were feeling. But if you'll take my word for it, I'll tell you that there were at least four reactions or responses among the exiles to what had happened to them. There was backsliding, bravado, bitterness, and brokenness. Four B's to make it easier to remember. There was backsliding. Some of them, we read in the book of Jeremiah, simply said, we were better off when we served other gods. It was far better for us when we weren't trying to worship this God, Yahweh. And so they rejected their God altogether. And they said, we're going to worship the Queen of Heaven, whoever she was. And they went off into the worship of other gods, saying, really far better if we hadn't stuck with Yahweh our God, because he's now beaten. So there was that kind of rejecting, backsliding response by some. Secondly, there was bravado. There were the false optimists. There were those who were saying, like the prophet Hananiah in Jerusalem in Jeremiah 28, don't worry, be happy, it'll all be over soon. Just a few more years and all the exiles will come back. God will be nice to us again. Don't worry, be happy. That was their message. We read about them too. There was a third response which was much more pessimistic than that. It was bitterness. There were some who accepted that it was God who had done this to them, but he was being desperately unfair. They hadn't done anything to deserve this. It was all their parents' fault. That's who they blamed. And they made up proverbs about it. They said, you know, our parents ate the dodgy food and we've got the tummy ache. That's not fair, is it? And so they were bitter, they were angry, and they were accusing God of being unjust and unfair. The fourth response was brokenness. There were some who accepted that this was what God had done, and they thought, well, that's it then. It's all over. It's the end for us, for Israel. There's no hope, there's no future. We might as well die in this place. In fact, we feel like dead bones already, was what they were saying. So those are the responses of this group of people at the exile, the people among whom God called Ezekiel to be a pastor and an evangelist and a prophet in their midst. And I dare say that some, at any rate, of those same kind of reactions can be in our hearts, may even find echoes in our hearts this evening. When we face crisis, whether a personal crisis of suffering, or sometimes in the face of great disasters that happen in the world, or possibly when, if we're from another country, some terrible news of wars or struggle or things happening on our own homeland, and some or any of these responses can be ours. I even wonder, did Ezekiel share some of them himself in those 5 years before God called him to be a prophet? We don't know. What was in his heart and mind? We know that he went from 25 to 30 in this situation with people who were thinking like this. In fact, we know very little about Ezekiel, really, apart from the fact that he was trained to be a priest, that he had a young wife who's described as the delight of his eyes later on in the book, and that he had been trained to be a priest. So it was really quite a shock and a change when God called him to be a prophet. Well, if any of those reflections and thinking was in Ezekiel's mind, they were very soon going to be challenged and answered by this vision that we now have to turn to in chapter 1. So I hope you've got it open in front of you. I wish I could make it into a kind of cinematic picture, because it needs all the imagination we can focus on it. What an experience this is. And of course, it's this vision of Ezekiel here in chapter 1 which lies behind a very similar vision at the other end of the Bible in the book of Revelation. If you look sometime at Revelation chapter 4, 5, 6, 7, there John, also in exile, interestingly, has a vision of the risen Christ. And into that vision come so many of the features that actually come from Ezekiel's vision here. If you look at Ezekiel 1, you see that the vision starts with a storm in verse 4 and ends with a throne in verse 26. And both of those together constitute the reality of the presence of the glory of God. Because in the Old Testament, they often sang in their psalms that the Lord is the God who rides in the storm. It's even entered into some of our hymns. You look, for example, later, look up Psalm 18, and you'll find there a great description of the Lord God riding on the wings of the storm, thunder and lightning. And, of course, the vision of God being highly exalted on a throne in verse 26 is also there in passages like Exodus 24. And you remember how Isaiah saw the Lord high and lifted up and seated on the throne. So it starts with a storm. And it's very probable that what Ezekiel thought as he was having his picnic by the river, possibly there with his wife, I don't know, there on his 30th birthday, probably he thought, we better go home because there's a rainstorm coming, a thundercloud approaching from the north across the sort of steamy plains of Mesopotamia. But this is no ordinary thunderstorm. As it approaches, he sees that it is filled with fire and lightning and flashing. I don't know, but you, if I'd been there, I'd have run the other way. I don't know what, how to believe this, Ezekiel. He just stands and looks at it. And he looks at it until eventually he realizes what it is, and then he falls on his face. But that only comes at the end of the chapter. He actually just stands and stares at this thing. Incredible courage. So let's follow Ezekiel's gaze as, first of all, he looks straight into it and sees the living creatures, as we shall see in verses 5 to 14. And then his gaze, as the camera angle swivels, he looks down in verses 15 to 21 and looks at the wheels at the base of the image. And then only then, and finally, he allows himself to look up, which he does from verses 22 to 28, and he sees what is above the image, the throne of God. So it's those three movements, in, down, and up, which we need to follow with our mental imagination as we follow the vision of Ezekiel. First of all, then, he tells us in verses 5 to 14 that as he saw this storm approach, he suddenly saw within it what you don't usually see in thunderstorms, which is these four living creatures. Now, they may seem very bizarre to us because they're standing upright, but they've got legs of bulls, they've got four heads, they've got four wings, and they're full of hands. They're really rather strange. But actually, in the world in which Ezekiel lived, this was common. This was the kind of statues that he would have seen around in the ancient Near East in the world of temples. They had these great stone creatures with multiple heads, wings, sometimes the legs and feet of bulls, with their hands upstretched, sometimes to hold up the sky or the throne of the god, sometimes just to guard the temples. Even Solomon puts two such creatures, they're called cherubim, in 1 Kings chapter 6, put two of them in the Holy of Holies in the temple in Jerusalem. They were 3 meters tall, they were made out of olive wood and covered with gold. And there they were, there in the presence of God, in the Holy of Holies. Probably Ezekiel had never seen them because he would never have been allowed into the Holy of Holies as an unordained priest. But he would certainly have seen this kind of statuary around the world in which he lived. And so what does he see? He sees these four heads on these four creatures. Human, speaking of wisdom and reason, the head of a lion, speaking of strength and majesty of the wild animals, the head of an ox, speaking of fertility especially, was what the ox or the bull symbolized, and the head of an eagle, speaking of speed and supremacy in the air, and also these four heads representing all of creation, human, wild, domesticated and in the sky and so on. The whole of creation and all its powers are here surrounding deity, all there to worship and, as it were, to support and to attend to the God who is obviously present. And these four wings which are upraised, and I think this is what we need to realize, is that these four creatures are not standing side by side in a straight line, they're actually arranged in a square, like this, sideways, and four, so actually facing four directions. They had four heads, so they're facing all directions, but their wings were touching at the top in a kind of quadrangle. And what he noticed was not only that there was flashing fire in this whole vision, but they were dynamically moving. In fact, it's hard to know how Ezekiel actually saw what they looked like, but they never stood still until near the end of his vision. He says that they were moving backwards and forwards, flashing this way and that way in the midst of the storm, in all four directions. So Ezekiel's curiosity gets the better of him. He wonders, how on earth are they moving like that? They never seem to turn around. They don't swivel. They just move any direction they want. And so he looks down to see what's causing it. And he sees that they had legs, but they weren't running. They had wings, but they weren't flying. What was moving them were these wheels. And this is amazing. And it's very difficult to imagine exactly what he saw. In fact, he finds it hard himself to describe what he saw, but it's given to the English language the expression wheels within wheels for anything that is convoluted and complicated, which it doubtless was. But with these wheels at the base, they were somehow able to move in any direction, a bit like casters, really, is probably the nearest we've got. Point is, of course, that Ezekiel wasn't interested just in the engineering of the thing. Remember, this is a vision. He wasn't actually there able to go and sort of tap on it and unscrew something and work out how it all fitted together. This is just a great vision of these four creatures attending deity who could be instantly anywhere, anytime, any way they wanted. It's a dynamic vision. And on these wheels are eyes everywhere. So here is a picture of presence, dynamic presence in the world, animated by the Spirit, he says in verses 20 and 21. The Spirit, not so much the Spirit of the living creatures, I think it should be the Spirit of life in verse 21. The Spirit of life was in the wheels. Ezekiel is beginning to suspect what it is or who it is he's actually looking at. The Spirit is in this contraption. The Spirit that he was going to know so often in his prophecy. And so he actually dares now to lift up his gaze. Having looked down to see this locomotion, he now looks up to see what is above. And above the heads of the four creatures, he sees this great transparent platform or dome, which he says is like crystal or like ice, sparkling, gleaming white and transparent that you can see through. Again, in many ancient Near Eastern religious pictures and drawings that people have found sometimes on stones and on seals, in other words, there are many examples of this, of creatures like this either holding up the sky so it doesn't fall down or holding up the throne of God in some sense. So what Ezekiel is seeing here is this reality of the supremacy of God above all else that surrounds him. High above this dome of sparkling white, he sees a throne of deepest blue, sapphire color. And high up on the throne, he sees what looks like something like the image of a man, he says. And that figure on the throne is of burning amber, a kind of deep orange-yellow color. And all around this throne and this man on the throne, there are the colors, all the colors of the rainbow. Can you imagine it? Even the sheer brilliance of the colors of this vision is overwhelming. The sparkling white, the blue of the throne, the amber of the figure on the throne, and all the colors of the rainbow around it. Here is sheer splendor in the presence of God. It's not particularly surprising that when God appears like this, he appears to look like a human being, because as Ezekiel well knew, God made human beings in his own image, and so when God appears, he can appear in the image of the human form, until of course the time would come when he actually took flesh and became one of us. Now it seems that at this point, and only at this point, does Ezekiel actually realize what he's looking at. This is not some pagan god of Babylon with its sphinxes and its guardian angels around the temple. This is none other than the Lord, Yahweh, Jehovah, the Holy One of Israel. In fact, it's the very glory of this God that he's in the presence of. The glory meaning the weight, the substance, the reality of the presence of the living God on the throne of the universe. And at last, Ezekiel is overwhelmed and undone. And he collapses face down in shock when he says, "I knew what I'd seen." And he can hardly bring himself to tell us what he's seen. We say, did you see the Lord? No, I can't have seen the Lord. You're not allowed to see the Lord. Then did you see the glory of the Lord? Well, was it the glory of the Lord? He says it was just the likeness of the appearance of the glory of the Lord. And even that was enough to flatten him on his face. I'm amazed he stood there looking at it for so long, aren't you? But at least he was looking at it long enough to tell us what he saw. So what does it all mean then? What does it mean for Ezekiel, for the Israelites in exile, and for us? Remember again those four reactions that we find among the exiles, which I said quite possibly might also be reflected among us. Backsliding or rejection of God, bravado, bitterness, and brokenness. How does this staggering vision of God that Ezekiel has seen, how does it address such thoughts and responses? Well, it seems to me that it says at least three things about God that we need to put together from this vision. It tells that God is up there on the throne, that God is out there in charge in the world, and that God is right here in our midst. All three are in this vision. First of all, God is on his throne. That's the reality of the final part of the vision. It's a vision of enormous altitude. Do you get that feeling? Do you remember how scared you were as a little child of things that looked very big, very tall, very high? I used to think my mother was awfully tall. She was only about 5 foot nothing, but I remember as a little boy thinking how big she looked. And the big boys at school and the big skyscrapers. When anything is hugely tall, we are filled with a sense of transcendence. And here is the altitude of God. As Isaiah said in his vision, "I saw the Lord high and lifted up." And we live in a culture which has become so flat and so horizontal and so two-dimensional. All we're interested in is image and surface. And we've lost any of the sense of depth or of glory or of altitude, even in our culture around us, certainly in the Western world. We need some triangulation, some sense of the sheer exaltation of the living God. So that those of us, you see, who are tempted, like some of the exiles, to think that, well, maybe we'd be better off without God. Maybe getting into all this Christianity stuff was a bit of a mistake. Can I really stick with it? Wouldn't I be better going off on my own, pursuing my own goals, my own agenda, my own gods? We need to be reminded, like Ezekiel and the exiles, that there is only one throne at the center of the universe, and there's only one occupant on that throne, and it's the living God of all power and glory in all his height and exaltation. And those of us who might be tempted perhaps to a little bit of bravado, like again some of the exiles, well, it'll all be okay, it's all going to work out for the best. I mean, let's be mature about this. You don't really want to believe all that stuff we were taught as children just to make us be good or just to scare us into behaving. You know, just let's grow up a bit and, you know. We need to remember, if that's the way we think, that the predominant impression of Ezekiel's vision, both below the expanse and above it, was the vision of fire and of burning brightness of the holiness of God. And Ezekiel is going to have some pretty scorching things to say about God's attitude to human beings who treat him with contempt and rebellion and dismiss him, not only in the world, because Ezekiel wasn't a prophet of Babylon, but among God's people, because Ezekiel was a prophet to the exiles of God's people in Babylon. And he will have a lot to say to them. The next few weeks of this course are not going to be very easy. It'll get better, but the next few won't be easy. So that's God on the throne, God using Ezekiel's spatial metaphors, God up there. But then there's also God out there, God in control, these four living creatures, as it were, under the dome of heaven, with their wings and their wheels and everything else, speaking of the presence and the power of God everywhere throughout his whole creation. Nothing that goes on goes unnoticed or hidden or unseen by God. So those of us who might be tempted, like some of the exiles, to bitterness, tempted to think that maybe God is being unfair because he hasn't taken this into consideration or that into consideration, and he's not really treating us as we deserve, we need to be reminded that this is the God who sees all, who knows all, who is the utterly righteous judge, who misses nothing, and who is able to be in and to see all four corners of the earth simultaneously. That's what this vision of movement is symbolizing. A God of faithfulness and without injustice, good and upright is he. And thirdly, not only God up there and God out there, but God right here in our midst. I think this must have been the biggest shock for Ezekiel of all. I mean, what on earth was the God of Israel doing here in Babylon? He was supposed to be back in Jerusalem, where all the exiles wanted to be. He was supposed to be in his temple. That's where God should be, the Lord God, Yahweh, Jehovah. Probably right up to this moment, Ezekiel felt that not only was he far away from God, but God was far away from him, 1,000 miles away. Actually, a little bit later, Ezekiel was going to have a vision in chapters 8 to 10 of the Lord God leaving his temple. It's a horrendous vision, and you'll come to that in a few weeks. But at this point, the most marvelous word in this passage is, there in Babylon, the Lord God appeared to Ezekiel. The Lord arrives in Babylon. So you see, the God who is up there, exalted in glory on his throne, the God who is out there in the world, sovereign, all-seeing, governing the world by his say-so, is the God who is also right here with the exiles in Babylon. Unclean, pagan, enemy Babylon. The Lord was there. And so those of us who may perhaps share something of that fourth response that I mentioned of the exiles, the brokenness, those who feel that God seems so far away, that something has happened as a result of which there no longer seems any possible hope or future in your life or your family or your country or your situation or whatever it is, we need also to have something of the nearness of God in Ezekiel's vision from this chapter. Yes, of course, there's an awful lot more severe warning and words that are going to come. Ezekiel is going to have 5 years of the most uncomfortable message that any prophet had to bring over these next chapters. But there would also be comfort. There would be hope. There would be reassurance and forgiveness and new life. Why? Because God is here. God has arrived. And when God is here, there is hope. And that's why the opening and the closing words of Ezekiel's whole book are just this one word. There. It's there in chapter 1, verse 3. There the hand of the Lord was upon me. Where? In Babylon, in the world. Pagan, unclean Babylon. There, not in the temple, not in Jerusalem, but right there, God was present with his people. And the very last word of the book of Ezekiel, in chapter 48, verse 35, gives the name of the city of God that Ezekiel will see in his great climactic vision. And the name of the city where God will be with his people, the name of the city is, the Lord is
there. Wherever
God's people are, that is where God is. Just as Jesus promised us that wherever his people are, there am I in the midst of them. Well, I don't know whether there are any here tonight who feel like exiles or have any sense of identifying with the feelings that I mentioned earlier of these Israelites in exile, possibly spiritually, when God seems far away, possibly even just physically, when we're far from our own homeland or culture, as many of you are, from our familiar place of worship, where we met the Lord, where the people we know the Lord are. Here we are in a strange foreign country, as the exiles were. Well, perhaps for us also comes this challenge and this comfort and the encouragement of this message that came to Ezekiel in this vision. Our God is still on the throne. And our God is still in charge of the world. But most important of all, God is not just up there, not just out there, but God is right here, where we are, with us. And not just here in church, but God will be there with you tomorrow, at work. Wherever you go with God, with this vision, this reality. Maybe prove something of the blessing and encouragement and challenge of that this coming week, for his name's sake. Amen.